fighting. I had been able to find ways to cheat, by and large. In a one-on-one duel, I wasn't going to be able to fall back on cleverness to take advantage of whatever I could find in my environment. This was going to be a straight fight, and if Ortega was better than me, he'd kill me. Simple as that. The fear was simple, too. Simple and undeniable. I swallowed, and my knuckles turned white. I tried to relax my fingers, but they wouldn't. They were too afraid to let go of the wheel. Stupid fingers. I got back to my apartment, pried my fingers off the steering wheel, and found my door halfway open. I ducked to one side in case someone had a gun pointed up the narrow stairway down to my apartment door and drew out my blasting rod. "Harry?" called a quiet female voice from my apartment. "Harry, is that you?" I lowered the blasting rod. "Murph?" "Get inside," Murphy said. I looked down the stairway and saw her appear in the doorway, her face pale. "Hurry!" I came down the stairs warily, feeling out my wards as I did. They were intact, and I relaxed a little. I had given Murphy a personalized talisman that would let her through my defenses, and it would only have worked for her. I slipped into my apartment. Murphy shut the door behind me and locked it. She'd started a fire in the fireplace and had one of my old kerosene lamps lit. I went to the fireplace and warmed up my hands, watching Murphy in silence. She stood with her back and shoulders rigid for a moment before she came over to stand beside me, facing the fire. Her lips were held into a tense, neutral line. "We should talk."
"People keep saying that to me," I muttered.
"You promised me you'd call me in when you had something."
"Whoa there, hang on. Who said I had anything?"
"There is a corpse on a pleasure ship in Burnham Harbor and several eyewitnesses who describe a tall, dark-haired man leaving the scene and getting into a multicolored Volkswagen Beetle."
"Wait a second.
There's been a murder, Dresden. I don't care how sacred client confidentiality is to you. People are dying."
Frustration made me clench my teeth. "I was going to tell you about it. It's been a really busy day."
"Too busy to talk to the police about a murder you may have witnessed?" Murphy said. "That is considered aiding and abetting a first-degree murder in some places, like courts of law."
"This again," I muttered, my fingers clenched into fists. "I remember how this one goes. You slug me in the jaw and arrest me."
"I damn well should."
"Hell's bells, Murph."
"Relax," she sighed. "If that was what I had in mind, you'd be in the car already." My anger evaporated.
"Oh."
After a moment, I asked, "Then why are you here?"
Murphy scowled.
"I'm on vacation."
"You're what?"
Murphy's jaw twitched. Her words sounded a little odd, since she kept her teeth ground together while she talked. "I've been taken off the case. And when I protested, I was told that I could either be on vacation or collecting unemployment."
Holy crap.
The muckety mucks at CPD had ordered Murphy off a case? But why? Murphy answered the question I hadn't asked yet. "Because when Butters looked at the victim from the harbor, he determined that the weapon used to kill her and the one used on that victim you saw last night were the same."
I blinked.
"What?" "Same weapon," Murphy said. "Butters seemed pretty confident about it." I turned that over in my head a few times, trying to shake out the kinks in the chains of logic.
"I need a beer. You?"
"Yeah." I went over to the pantry and grabbed a couple of brown bottles. I used an old bottle opener to take off the lids and took the drinks back to Murphy. She took her bottle in hand and eyed it suspiciously.
"It's warm."
"It's the new recipe. Mac would kill me if he heard I served his brown cold." I took a pull from my bottle. The ale had a rich, full flavor, a little nutty, and it left a pleasant aftertaste lingering in the mouth. Make what jokes you will about trendy microbrews. Mac knew his stuff. Murphy made a face.
"Ugh, too much taste."
"Wimpy American," I said. Murphy almost smiled.
Homicide got wind that there was a link between the killing in Italy, the one here by the airport, and the one this morning. So they pulled strings and hogged the whole thing.
How did they find out?
Rudolph, Murphy spat. There's no way to prove anything, but I'll bet you the little weasel heard me on the phone with Butters and ran straight over there to tell them.
Isn't there anything you can do?
Officially, yes. But in real life, people are going to start accidentally losing reports and forms and requests if I try to file them. And when I tried to apply some pressure of my own, I got put down hard. She took another angry drink. I could lose my job.
That both sucks and blows, Murph.
Tell me about it. She frowned and looked up at my eyes briefly. Harry, I want you to back off on this case. For your own sake. That's why I came over here.
I frowned. Wait a minute. You mean people are threatening you with me? That's a switch.
Don't joke about it, Murphy said. Harry, you've got a history with the department, and not everyone thinks well of you.
You mean Rudolph?
Not just Rudolph. There are plenty of people who don't want to believe you're for real. Besides that, you were near the scene of, and may have witnessed, a felony. They could put you away.
Obviously, my life was too easy already. I swigged more beer. Murph, cop, crook, or creature, it doesn't matter. I don't back off because some bully doesn't like what I do.
I'm not a bully, Harry. I'm your friend.
I winced. And you're asking me.
She nodded. Pretty please? With sugar?
With sugar. Hell, Murph. I took a drink and squinted at her. How much do you know about what's going on?
I had some of the files taken away before I could read them, she glanced up at me. But I can read between the lines.
Okay, I said. This might take a little explaining.
You aren't backing off, are you?
It isn't an option.
Stop there, then, Murphy said. The less you tell me, the less I can testify to.
Testify? Hell.
There should be some kind of rule about being forced to dodge several kinds of legal landmines at the same time.
This isn't a friendly situation, I said. If straight cops go into it like it's normal business, they're going to get killed. I'd be really worried even if it were SI.
Okay, Murphy said. She didn't look happy. She drank her beer in a long pull and set the bottle on my mantle. I put my hand on her shoulder. She didn't snap it off at the wrist. Murph, this looks bad already. I have a hunch it could get worse, fast. I have to.
I know, she said. I wish I could help. Did you get the information on that cell phone?
No, she said. But as she said it, she passed me a folded piece of paper. I unfolded it with my fingers and read Murphy's printing. Quebec Nationale, Inc. Owner. No phone number. Address a P.O. box. Dead end.
A dummy company, probably, I thought.
The church mice could have set it up to do a lot of the buying and selling for them. Maybe Dead Gaston had been from Quebec instead of France.
Got it. Thanks, Murph.
I don't know what you're talking about, Murphy said. She picked up her jacket from where she'd tossed it onto my couch and shrugged into it. There's no APB out for you yet, Harry, but I'd be discreet if I were you.
Discreet, that's me.
I'm serious.
Serious, yep.
Damn it, Harry.
But she smiled when she said it. You probably don't want me to call you if I need help.
She nodded. Hell no. That would be illegal. Keep your nose clean. Walk the straight and narrow.
Okay.
Murphy paused and asked, I don't think I've seen you without that coat outside of summer. Where's your duster?
I grimaced. Missing in action.
Oh, you talked to Susan?
Yeah.
I felt Murphy's eyes on my face. She got it without being told. Oh, she said again. Sorry, Harry.
Thanks.
See you.
She opened my door, kept her hand near her gun, and then warily padded on out.
I shut my door after her and leaned against it.
Murphy was worried. She wouldn't have come to see me in person if she weren't. And she'd been extra careful with the legal stuff. Were things that dicey in the CPD? Murphy was the first head of special investigations not to get her rear bounced onto the street after a token week or three of unsolvable cases. Generally speaking, when the administration wanted someone off the force, they'd get promoted to running SI, or at least working in it. Every cop there had some kind of failing that had landed them what everyone else considered to be a cruddy assignment. It had, by and large, created a strong sense of camaraderie among the SI officers, a bond only made tighter by the way they occasionally faced off with one kind of nightmarish creature or another. SI cops had taken down several half-assed dark spell slingers, half a dozen vampires, seven or eight ravening trolls, and a demon that had manifested itself out of a mound of compost-heated garbage behind a pawn shop in Chinatown. SI could handle itself pretty well because they played careful. They worked together. And they understood that there were unnatural beings that sometimes had to be dealt with in ways not strictly in accordance with police procedure. Oh, and because they had a hired wizard to advise them about bad guys, of course. I like to think that I had contributed, too. But I guess every bucket of fruit has something go rotten sooner or later. In SI, the stinker was Detective Rudolph. Rudy was young, good-looking, clean-cut, and had slept with the wrong councilman's daughter. He had applied some industrial-strength denial to his experiences with SI, despite freak encounters with monsters, magic, and human kindness. He had clung to a steadfast belief that everything was normal, and the realm of the paranormal was all make-believe. Rudy didn't like me. Rudy didn't like Murphy. If the kid had sabotaged Murphy's investigation in order to curry favor with the folks in Homicide, maybe he was angling to get out of SI. And maybe he'd lose a bunch of teeth the next time he walked through a quiet parking garage. I doubted Murphy would take that kind of backstabbing with good grace. I spent a moment indulging myself in a pleasant fantasy in which Murphy pounded Rudy's head against the door of her office at SI's home building until the cheap wood had a Rudolph-shaped dent in it. I enjoyed the thought way too much. I gathered up a few things from around my apartment, including the anti-venom potions Bob had helped me with. I checked on Bob while I was in the lab and got a sleepy and incoherent response that I understood to mean that he needed more rest. I let him, went back upstairs, and called my answering service. I had a message from Susan, a phone number. I called it, and a second later she answered, "Harry, you've become clairvoyant. If you can do a foreign accent, you could get a hotline." "Like, sure, as if," Susan drawled ditzily. "California isn't foreign," I said. "You'd be surprised. How did things go?" "Okay, I guess," I said. "I got a second." "Michael?" she asked. "Shiro." "Who?" "He's like Michael, but shorter. And older." "Oh, good. I did the legwork." I thought of some work I'd seen Susan's legs do before, but I only said, "And?" "And the downtown Marriott is hosting an art gala this very night, including a gallery sale and a fundraiser auction for charity." I whistled. "Wow. So lots of art and money moving around, changing hands, being shipped hither and yon." "Hither, maybe, but I don't think UPS does yon," Susan said. "Seems like a good place to sell a hot article or three, and it's all sponsored by the Chicago Historical and Art Society."
"Who?"
"A very small and very elite club for the upper crust. Gentleman Johnny Marcone is chairman of its board of directors."
"Sounds like smuggling country, all right," I said. "How do I get in?"
"You put up a $5,000 per plate donation to charity."
"$5,000?" I said. "I don't think I've ever had that much all in one place at one time."
"Then you might try option two."
"Which is?"
Susan's voice took on a note of satisfaction. "You go with a reporter from the Midwest Arcane on her last assignment for her editor. I talked to Trish and got two tickets that had originally been given to a reporter on the Tribune."
"I'm impressed," I said.
"It gets better. I got us formal wear. The gala begins at 9.
"Us?"
Susan, I don't want to sound like an ass, but do you remember the last time you wanted to come on an investigation with me?" "This time I'm the one with the tickets," she said. "Are you coming with me or not?"
I thought about it for a minute, but didn't see any way around it. There wasn't time for a long argument, either.
I'm in. I have to meet the Reds at McAnally's at 8.
Meet you there with your tux. 8:30?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure, she said quietly. Glad I could help.
Silence stretched long enough to become painful for both of us. I finally broke it at the same time as Susan.
Well, I'd better let you go, Susan said. I have to hurry to get all of this done.
All right, I said. Be careful.
Stones and glass houses, Harry. See you this evening.
We hung up, and I made sure I was ready to go.
Then I went to pick up my second and work out the terms to a duel I was increasingly certain I had little chance of surviving.
Chapter 17. I put on an old fleece-lined denim jacket and went by my office. The night security guy gave me a little trouble, but I eventually browbeat him into opening the safe in the office to retrieve my envelope from Father Vincent. I opened it and found a plastic case the size of a playing card, like the kind coin collectors use to frame paper money. In the exact center of the case was a single, dirty white thread about 2 inches long, the sample from the shroud. It wasn't much to work with. I could use the thread to create a channel to the rest of the shroud, but nothing was certain. The thread had presumably been absent from the rest of the shroud for going on 30 years. Not only that, but it had presumably been handled by various scientists or clergy, and it was possible that they had left enough of a psychic residue on the thread to cloud a seeking spell. On top of all that, the thread was tiny. I would have to be extremely careful if I used a spell to go hunting the shroud, or the forces in it would overload the thread in the same way that enough electrical current will overload the filament in a light bulb. I'm not so great with delicate spell work. I've got plenty of power, but fine control of it could be a problem. By necessity, I would have to use a very gentle spell, and that would put severe limits on the range of it. A spell would be a metal detector, rather than a radar dish, but it was a whole lot better than nothing. I hit the door. Rather than inflicting another charity encounter upon myself, I pulled the beetle up to the curb in front of Michael's house and honked the horn. A moment later, Shiro appeared. The little old man had shaved the white down from his head, and where he didn't have liver spots, the skin shone. He wore some kind of loose-fitting black pants that looked a lot like the ones I'd seen Murphy wear at one of her Aikido tournaments. He also wore a black shirt and a white gi jacket with a scarlet cross on either side of his chest. A belt of red silk held the jacket closed, and he wore his sword through it, still in its wooden cane sheath. He opened the door, slipped into the beetle, and held his sword across his lap. I got going, and neither of us said anything for a while. My knuckles were getting white again, so I started talking.
"So, you've done one of these duels before?"
"Aye," he said, nodding.
"Many times."
"Why?"
Shiro shrugged. "Many reasons. Protect someone, force something to leave an area in peace, fight without involving others."
"To the death?"
Shiro nodded. "Many times."
"Guess you're pretty good at it, then," I said. Shiro smiled a little, eyes wrinkling even more.
"Always someone better."
"You ever dueled a vampire?"
"Aye. Jade Court. Black Court."
"Jade Court," I said. "I've never heard that there was such a thing."
"Southeast Asia. China. Japan. Very secretive. But they respect the Accords."
"Have you dueled any of the Denarians?" He frowned out the window.
"Twice. But they do not honor agreements. Treachery, both times."
I thought that over for a while before I said, "I'm going for energy. If he won't take it, we'll do will."
Shiro glanced aside at me and nodded. "But there is a better choice."
"What?"
"Don't fight. Can't lose a fight you don't have."
I felt a snort coming on, but I held it back. "I'm sort of locked into it now."
"Both parties want to quit. Duel over," Shiro said. "I will be talking to Ortega second. Ortega will be there. Smart for you to try to talk him out of it."
"I don't think he'll do it."
"Maybe, maybe not. Not fighting always smarter,"
says the militant knight of the cross and his holy blade.
"I hate fighting."
I glanced at him for a second and said, You don't usually hear that from someone good at it. Shiro smiled. Fighting is never good, but sometimes necessary. I blew out a deep breath. Yeah, I guess I know what you mean. The rest of the ride to McAnally's was quiet. In the streetlights, my knuckles looked the same color as the rest of my hands. McAnally's is a tavern. Not a bar, not a pub, but an actual old-world-style tavern. When I went in, I stepped down 3 steps to the hardwood floor and looked around the place. The bar has 13 stools at it. There were 13 columns of dark wood, each one hand-carved with swirling leaves and images of beings of tale and fantasy. 13 tables had been spaced out around the room in an irregular pattern, and like the columns and bar stools, they had been intentionally placed that way in order to deflect and scatter random magical energies. It cut down on the accidents from grumpy wizards and clueless kids just discovering their power. Several ceiling fans whirled lazily and were low enough that I always felt a bit nervous about one of them whirling into my eyebrows. The place smells of wood smoke, old whiskey barrels, fresh bread, and roasting meat. I like it. Mac stood behind the bar. I didn't know much about Mac. He was tall, medium build, bald, and somewhere between 30 and 60. He had large and facile hands and thick wrists. All I've ever seen him wear is dark pants with a loose white shirt and an apron that somehow remained free of splatters of grease, spilled drinks, and the various other things he prepared for customers. Mac caught my eye when I came in and nodded to my left. I looked. A sign on the wall said, "Accorded Neutral Ground." I looked back at Mac. He drew a shotgun out from behind the bar so that I could see it and said, "Got it?" "No problem," I answered. "Good." The room was otherwise empty, though normally there would be a couple of dozen members of the local magical scene. Not full-fledged wizards or anything, but there were plenty of people with a dab of magical talent. Then there were a couple of different Wiccan groups, the occasional changeling, scholars of the arcane, a gang of do-gooder werewolves, members of secret societies, and who knew what else. Mac must have put out the word that a meeting was happening here. No one sane wants to be anywhere close to what could be a fight between a white council member and a red court warlord. I knew I was sane because I didn't want to be there either. I walked over to the bar and said, "Beer." Mac grunted and plopped down a bottle of brown. I pushed some bills at him, but he shook his head. Shiro stood at the bar next to me, facing the opposite way. Mac put a bottle down beside him. Shiro twisted off the cap with one hand, took a modest sip, and set the bottle back down. Then he glanced at it, thoughtfully, picked it up, and took a slower sip.
"Yosh,"
Mac grunted.
"Thanks."
Shiro said something in what I guessed was Japanese. Mac answered monosyllabically. A man of many talents and few syllables is Mac. I killed time with a couple more sips and the door opened. Kincaid walked in the same outfit I'd seen that morning, but without the baseball cap. His dark blonde hair was instead pulled back into an unruly tail. He nodded at Mac and asked, "All set?"
"Ugh,"
said Mac. Kincaid prowled the room, looking under tables and behind columns, and checked the restrooms and behind the counter as well. Mac said nothing, but I had the impression that he felt the precaution to be useless. Kincaid went to a corner table, nudging other tables back from it a bit, and put 3 chairs around it. He drew a gun out of a shoulder rig and set it on the table, then took a seat. "Hi," I said toward him. "Nice to see you, too. Where's Ivy?"
"Past her bedtime," Kincaid said without smiling. "I'm her proxy."
"Oh," I said. "She has a bedtime?" Kincaid checked his watch.
"She believes very strongly in an early bedtime for children."
I don't fake amused chuckles well.
"So, where's Ortega?"
"Saw him parking outside," Kincaid said. The door opened and Ortega entered. He wore a casual black blazer with matching slacks and a shirt of scarlet silk. He hadn't worn a coat despite the cold. His skin was darker than I remembered it. Maybe he'd fed recently. He carried himself with a relaxed, patient quality as he entered and surveyed the room. He bowed slightly at the waist toward Mac, who nodded back. The vampire's eyes landed on Shiro and narrowed. Shiro said nothing and did not move. Ortega then regarded me with an unreadable expression and gave me a very slight nod. It seemed polite to nod back to him, so I did. Ortega did the same to Kincaid, who returned it with a lazy wave of one hand.
"Where is your second?" Kincaid asked.
Ortega grimaced.
"Primping."
He hadn't finished the word before a young man slapped the door open and stepped jauntily into the tavern. He was wearing tight, white leather pants, a black fishnet shirt, and a white leather jacket. His hair was dark and hung to his shoulders in an unruly mane. He had a male model's face, smoky gray eyes, and thick, dark eyelashes. I knew him. Thomas Wraith, a White Court vampire.
"Thomas," I said, by way of greeting.
"Evening, Harry," he answered. "What happened to your duster?"
"There was a woman."
"I see," Thomas said.
"Pity. It was the only thing you owned that gave me hope that there might be a feeble flicker of style in you."
"You should talk. That outfit you're wearing is treading dangerously close to the Elvis zone."
"Young, sleek Elvis ain't bad," Thomas said.
"I meant old, fat Elvis, possibly Michael Jackson."
The pale man put a hand to his heart.
"That hurts, Harry."
"Yeah, I've had a rough day, too."
"Gentlemen," Kincaid said, a note of impatience in his voice, "shall we begin?" I nodded. So did Ortega. Kincaid introduced everyone and produced a document that stated he was working for the archive. It was written in crayon. I drank some more beer. After that, Kincaid invited Shiro and Thomas to join him at the corner table. I went back to the bar, and a moment later, Ortega followed me. He sat down with a couple of empty stools between us, while Kincaid, Thomas, and Shiro spoke quietly in the background. I finished my bottle and set it down with a thump. Mac turned around to get me another. I shook my head.
"Don't bother. I've got enough on my tab already."
Ortega put a 20 down on the bar and said,
"I'll cover it. Another for me as well."
I started to make a wise-ass remark about how buying me a beer would surely make up for threatening my life and the lives of those I cared about, but I bit it back. Shiro had been right about fighting. You can't lose a fight you don't show up to. So I took the beer Mac brought me and said, "Thanks, Ortega." He nodded and took a sip. His eyes lit up a bit, and he took a second, slower one.
"It's good,"
Mac grunted.
"I thought you guys drank blood," I said.
"It's all we really need," Ortega said.
"Then why do you have anything else?"
Ortega held up the bottle.
"Life is more than mere survival. All you need is the water, after all. Why drink beer?"
"You ever tasted the water in this town?"
He almost smiled.
"Touché."
I turned the plain brown bottle around in my fingers.
"I don't want this," I said.
"The duel?"
I nodded. Ortega leaned an elbow on the bar and considered me.
"Neither do I. This isn't personal. It isn't something I want."
"So don't do it," I said. "We could both walk."
"And the war would go on."
"It's been going on for nearly 2 years," I said. "It's mostly been cat and mouse, a couple of raids, fights in back alleys. It's like the Cold War, only with fewer Republicans."
Ortega frowned and watched Mac cleaning the grill behind the bar.
"It can get worse, Mr. Dresden. It can get a great deal worse. And if the conflict escalates, it will threaten the balance of power throughout the worlds of flesh and spirit alike. Imagine the destruction, the loss of life that could ensue."
"So why not contribute to the peace effort, starting with this duel? Maybe we could get some beads and some fringe and make signs that say, 'Make blood not war,' or something."
This time Ortega did smile. It was a weary expression on him.
"It's too late for that," he said. "Your blood is all that will satisfy many of my peers."
"I can donate," I said. "Let's say once every 2 months.
You provide cookies and orange juice. Ortega leaned toward me, the smile fading.
Wizard, you murdered a noble of our court. I got angry. My voice gained heat.
The only reason...
Ortega cut me off, lifting his hand.
I do not say that your reasons were not valid, but the fact of the matter is that you appeared in her home as a guest and representative of the council, and you attacked and eventually killed both Bianca and those under her protection.
Killing me won't bring her back, I said,
but it will slake the thirst for vengeance that plagues many of my kinsmen. When you are no more, they will be willing to at least attempt a peaceful resolution.
Damn it, I muttered and fiddled with the bottle.
Though, Ortega murmured, his eyes became distant for a moment. There might be another way.
What other way?
Yield, Ortega said. Yield to the duel and let me take you into custody. If you are willing to work with me, I could place you under my protection.
Work with you, I said. My stomach flip-flopped. You mean become like you?
It is an alternative to death, Ortega said, his expression earnest. My kinsmen may not like it, but they could not argue against it. For taking Bianca's life, you could replace it with your own.
As one of you?
Ortega nodded.
As one of us.
He was quiet for a moment, then said, You could bring Miss Rodriguez with you. Be together. She would not be a threat to you were you both my vassals. He put his beer down. I think you will find that we are much alike, Dresden. We're just playing for different teams.
I rubbed at my mouth. My instinctive reaction to Ortega's offer was one of revulsion.
The Red Court vampires don't look like most would think. They look like giant, hairless bats with slick, rubbery skin. They could cover themselves with a flesh mask in order to look human, but I'd seen what was underneath the mask. I'd been exposed to it, thoroughly. I still had nightmares. I opened my eyes.
Let me ask you a question.
Very well.
Do you live in a manor?
Casa Verde, Ortega responded. It's in Honduras. There is a village nearby.
Uh-huh, I said. So you feed on the villagers?
Carefully. I provide them with supplies, medical attention, other necessities.
Sounds reasonable, I said.
It's beneficial to both of us. The villagers know that.
Yeah, they probably do, I finished off the bottle. Do you feed on children?
Ortega frowned at me.
What do you mean?
I didn't bother to hide the anger in my voice.
Do you feed on children?
It's the safest way. The more the feeding is spread among many, the less dangerous it is for all of them.
You're wrong. We're different. I stood up. You hurt kids. We're done.
Ortega's voice sharpened.
Dresden, do not lightly discard my offer.
The offer to make me into a blood-drinking monster in eternal slavery to you? Why would I want to do that?
It is the only way to keep your life, Ortega said.
I felt the anger coalescing into rage. My upper lip curled away from my teeth, baring them in a snarl. I thought life is more than mere survival.
Ortega's expression changed. It was only for a second, but in that moment, I saw furious rage, arrogant pride, and violent bloodlust on his face. He regained his calm quickly, but traces of the hidden emotions thickened his accent.
So be it. I will kill you, wizard.
He sounded convincing. It scared me. I turned and walked to the door.
I'll be outside, I said to no one in particular, and stepped out into the late February cold. That way, I'd have an excuse to be trembling.
Chapter 18. I didn't have long to wait. The door opened behind me, and Kincaid emerged. He didn't say a word to me, just got into a rented sedan and left. Ortega came next. A car swung in off the street, and he opened the passenger door. He paused and looked back at me.
I have a measure of respect for your principles and skills, Dresden. But this situation is of your own making, and I cannot allow it to continue. I'm sorry.
I watched him get in the car, and I didn't offer him any reply. Hell, he hadn't said a word that was untrue. Ortega had a genuine axe to grind, and people, well, fellow monsters, to protect. And thus far, the Dresden versus Vampires scoreboard read a whole bunch to zero. If a vampire had done that to the White Council, I wonder if we would have reacted with as much reason and calm. The taillights of Ortega's car hadn't yet gotten out of sight when Thomas emerged from the tavern and swaggered casually over to me. Thomas was a shade under 6 feet tall, which put him at half a head shorter than me. He was better looking, though, and despite my earlier comments about his outfit, he was one of those men who made anything look good. The fishnet shirt he wore cast patterns of shadow over the pale skin beneath it, adding to the lines of muscle on his stomach. My stomach had muscles, but not so many that you could see them rippling. I'd have looked pathetic in a shirt like that.
That was simple enough, Thomas said.
He drew a pair of black leather driving gloves from his jacket pocket and started tugging them on.
Though I take it this duel isn't the only game in town at the moment.
Why would you say that? I asked.
I've had a pro hitter following me ever since I landed yesterday. The itch between my shoulder blades got annoying.
I glanced around. Is he here now? Thomas's eyes glittered.
No, I introduced him to my sisters.
The White Court were the most human of the vampires, and in some ways the weakest. They fed on psychic energies, on pure life force rather than on blood. Most often they would seduce those they fed upon, drawing life from them through physical contact during the act. If a couple of Thomas's sisters had met the hired gun tailing Thomas, the assassin probably wasn't going to be a problem to anyone, ever. My eye twitched.
The gunman was probably Ortega's, I said. He hired some goons to take out people I knew if I didn't agree to this duel.
That explains it, then, Thomas said. Ortega really doesn't like me much. Must be the unsavory company I've kept in the past.
Gee, thanks. How the hell did you end up his second?
It's my father's idea of a joke, Thomas said. Ortega asked him to be his second. Show of solidarity between the red and white courts. Instead, Daddy Dearest found the most annoying and insulting member of the family he possibly could to stand in.
You, I said.
C'est moi, Thomas confirmed with a little bow.
One would almost think father was trying to get me killed.
I felt one side of my mouth tug up into a smile. Nice father figure, him and Bill Cosby.
How's Justine?
Thomas grimaced.
She's in Aruba, is how she is, which is where I was until one of Papa Wraith's goons dragged me back up here.
What did you two decide on for the duel?
Thomas shook his head. Can't tell you. Shiro is supposed to do that. I mean, technically I'm at war with you.
I grimaced and stared after Ortega's vanished car.
Yeah.
Thomas was quiet for a second, then said,
He means to kill you.
I know.
He's dangerous, Harry. Smart. My father is afraid of him.
I could like him, I said. It's sort of refreshing to have someone trying to kill me right to my face, instead of throwing me a bunch of curveballs and shooting me in the back. It's almost nice to have a fair fight.
Sure, theoretically.
Theoretically?
Thomas shrugged.
Ortega's been alive for about 600 years. It isn't something you do by playing nice.
From what I've heard, the archive will object to any monkey business.
It's only cheating if it gets caught. I frowned at him and said, Are you saying someone is planning to avoid getting caught?
Thomas put his hands in his jacket pockets.
I'm not saying anything. I wouldn't mind seeing you kick his ass, but I'm sure as hell not going to do something that would attract attention to me.
You intend to participate without being involved,
That's clever. Thomas rolled his eyes. I won't throw a banana peel under you, but don't expect any help from me either. I'm just making sure it's a fair fight, and then I'm back at my beach house. He drew car keys from his pocket and headed for the parking lot. Good luck. Thomas, I said to his back, thanks for the heads up. He paused. I asked, why do it? The vampire glanced over his shoulder at me and smiled. Life would be unbearably dull if we had answers to all our questions. He walked out to a white sports car and slipped into it. A second later, loud, screaming metal music started from the car's stereo. The engine roared, and Thomas drove off. I checked my watch. 10 more minutes until Susan arrived. Shiro emerged from McAnally's and put on his glasses. Once he spotted me, he walked over and took the glasses off again.
Ortega refused to cancel the duel?
He made me an offer I couldn't excuse, I said. Shiro grunted.
Duel is Will's. Tomorrow, just after sundown. Wrigley Field.
A stadium? Why don't we put it on pay-per-view while we're at it? I glowered at the street and checked my watch again. I'm meeting someone in a minute. I'll give you the keys to my car. I can pick it up from Michael's tomorrow. No need, Shiro said. Mac called me a cab. Okay, I pocketed my keys. Shiro stood quietly for a moment, lips pursed thoughtfully, before he said,
Ortega means to kill you.
Yes. Yes, he does, I said. I managed not to grind my teeth as I said it.
Everyone is saying that like I didn't know it already. But you do not know how.
I frowned and looked down at Shiro. His shaved head gleamed under a nearby streetlight.
The war is not your fault.
I know that, I said, but my voice lacked conviction.
No, Shiro said. It truly is not your fault.
What do you mean?
The Red Court has been quietly building its resources for years, he said. How else were they ready to start their attacks in Europe only days after you defeated Bianca?
I frowned at him. Shiro drew a cigar from inside his jacket and bit off the end. He spat it to one side.
You were not the cause of the war. You were merely the excuse. The Reds would have attacked when they were ready.
No, I said. That's not how it is. I mean, damn near everyone I've spoken to on the council. Shiro snorted. He struck a match and puffed on the cigar a few times while he lit it.
The council. Arrogant. As if nothing significant could happen unless a wizard did it.
For someone who wasn't on the White Council, Shiro seemed to have its general attitude pretty well surrounded. If the Red Court wanted war, why is Ortega trying to stop it?
Premature, Shiro said. Needed more time to be completely prepared. The advantage of surprise is gone. He wishes to strike once and be certain it is a lethal stroke.
I watched the little old man for a minute. Everyone's got advice tonight. Why are you giving it?
Because, in some ways, you are every bit as arrogant as the council, though you do not realize it. You blame yourself for what happened to Susan. You want to blame yourself for more.
So what if I do? Shiro turned to me and faced me squarely. I avoided meeting his eyes.
Duels are a test of fire. They are fought in the will, the heart. If you do not find your balance, Ortega will not need to kill you. You will do so for him.
I guess you were a psychoanalyst before you were a sword-swinging vigilante against evil. Shiro puffed on the cheroot.
Either way, been alive longer than you. See more than you.
Like what?
Like this vampire warlord. How he manipulates you. He is not what he seems to be.
Really? I've never seen that one before, I said. Someone not what they appear to be. However will I adjust? Shiro shrugged.
He is centuries old. He is not from the same world. The world Ortega lived in was savage, brutal. Men like him destroyed entire civilizations for gold and glory. and for hundreds of years since then he has fought rival vampires, demons, and enemies of his kind. If he approaches you through formal, civilized channels, it is because he thinks it is the best way to kill you. Regardless of what happens in the duel, he intends to see you dead by any means necessary. Maybe before, maybe after, but dead.
Shiro didn't put any particular emphasis on the words. He didn't need to. They were enough to scare me without any added dramatics. I glowered at his cigar and said, "Those things will kill you." The old man smiled again.
"Not tonight."
I'd think a good Christian boy wouldn't be puffing down the cigars.
"Technicality," Shiro said.
"The cigars?"
"My Christianity," Shiro said. "When I was a boy, I liked Elvis. Had a chance to see him in concert when we moved to California. It was a big revival meeting. There was Elvis, and then a speaker, and my English was not so good. He invited people backstage to meet the king. Thought he meant Elvis, so I go backstage," he sighed. "Found out later I had become a Baptist."
I barked out a laugh. "You're kidding."
"No. But it was done. So I tried not to be too bad at being Baptist."
He rested a hand on the handle of his sword.
"Then came into this. Made the whole thing more simple. I serve."
"Serve who?"
"Heaven. Or the divine in nature. The memory of my father's past. My fellow man. Myself. All pieces of the same thing. Do you know the story of the blind man and the elephant?"
"Have you heard the one about the bear that walks into a bar?" I responded.
"I think that is a no," Shiro said. "Three blind men were shown an elephant. They touched it with their hands to determine what the creature was. The first man felt the trunk and claimed that an elephant was like a snake. The second man touched its leg and claimed that an elephant was like a tree. The third man touched its tail and claimed that the elephant was like a slender rope."
I nodded. "Oh, I get it. All of them were right. All of them were wrong. They couldn't get the whole picture." Shiro nodded.
"Precisely. I am just another blind man. I do not get the whole picture of what transpires in all places. I am blind and limited. I would be a fool to think myself wise. And so, not knowing what the universe means, I can only try to be responsible with the knowledge, the strength, and the time given to me. I must be true to my heart."
"Sometimes that isn't good enough," I said. He tilted his head and looked up at me.
"How do you know?"
A cab swerved in from the street and rattled to a stop. Shiro stepped over to it and nodded to me.
"We'll be at Michael's if you need me. Be watchful."
I nodded at him. "Thank you." Shiro said,
"Thank me after."
Then he got into the cab and left. Mac closed up shop a minute later and put on a dark fedora on his way out. He nodded at me on the way to his Trans Am and said nothing. I found a shadowy spot to linger in as Mac left and kept an eye on the street. I'd hate for someone to drive by and shoot me with a plain old gun. Embarrassing. A long, dark limo pulled into the parking lot. A uniformed driver got out and opened the door nearest to me. A pair of long, honey-brown legs slid out of the limo on top of black stiletto heels. Susan glided out of the car, managing grace despite the shoes, which probably qualified her for superhuman status all by itself. A sleeveless sheath of shimmering black cloth clung to her, an evening gown slit high on one side. Dark gloves covered her arms to the elbow, and her hair had been done up in a pile on top of her head, held in place with a couple of gleaming black chopsticks. My tongue dropped out of my mouth and flopped onto my shoes. Well, not literally, but if I'd been a cartoon, my eyeballs would have been about 6 feet long. Susan had read my face and apparently enjoyed my reaction.
"How much, good-looking?"
I looked down at my rumpled clothing.
"I think I'm a tad underdressed."
"One tuxedo coming up," Susan said. The driver opened the trunk and drew out a hanger covered with a dry-cleaning bag. When he turned around with it, I realized that the driver was Martin. All he'd done to disguise himself was don an archetypal uniform, and I hadn't even recognized him until second glance. I guess sometimes it's handy to be bland. "Is it my size?" I asked, taking the tux when Martin passed it to me.
"I had to guess," Susan said, lowering her eyelids in a sultry expression. "But it wasn't like I didn't know my way around."
Martin's face might have flickered with disapproval. My heart sped up a bit.
"All right, then," I said. "Let's get moving. I'll dress on the way."
"Do I get to look?" Susan asked.
"It'll cost you extra," I said.
Martin opened the door for Susan, and I slid in after her. I filled her in on what I'd found out about the shroud and those after it.
"I should be able to find the thing if we get close."
"You think there will be any more of these Denarians there?"
"Probably," I said. "If anything gets ugly, we'll take the best part of valor, pronto. These guys play hardball."
Susan nodded agreement.
"Sounds like the thieves aren't exactly shy about waving guns, either."
"And we'll have Marcone around, too. Whither he goeth, there too goeth armed thugs and homicide investigations." Susan smiled. It was a new expression to me, a small, quiet, fierce little smile that showed her teeth. It looked natural on her.
"You're all about fun, aren't you, Harry?"
"I am the Bruce Lee of fun," I concurred. "Give me some space here."
Susan slid over as far as she could to give me room to climb into the tux. I tried not to mar it too badly in the limited space. Susan glanced at me with a faint frown.
"What?" I asked her.
"You're wrinkling it."
"This isn't as easy as I'm making it look," I responded.
"If you weren't staring at my legs, maybe it wouldn't be such a challenge."
"I wasn't staring," I lied. Susan smiled at me as the car cruised through downtown, and I did my best to dress like Roger Moore. Her expression became thoughtful after a moment, and she said,
"Hey."
"What?"
"What happened to your leather coat?"
Chapter 19. The downtown Marriott was huge, brilliantly lit, and busy as an anthill. Several blue and whites were parked nearby, and a couple of officers were helping to direct traffic in front of the hotel. I could see maybe 20 limos on the street and pulling through the archway in front of the hotel doors, and every one of them looked bigger and nicer than ours. Valets rushed around to park the cars of guests who had driven themselves. There were a dozen men in red jackets standing around with bored expressions that some might mistake for inattention. Hotel security. Martin pulled up to the entryway and said, "I'll wait for you out here." He passed a palm-sized cell phone to Susan. She slipped it into a black clutch. "If you get into trouble, speed dial 1. At that point, a valet opened the door on my side, and I slipped out of the car. My rental tux felt a little awkward. The shoes were long enough for me, but they were an inch and a half too wide. I shrugged my jacket into place, straightened the cummerbund, and offered a hand to Susan. She slid out of the car with a brilliant smile and straightened my tie. "Smile," she said quietly. "Everyone here is worried about image. If you walk in scowling like that, we won't blend in." I smiled in what I thought was a camouflaging manner. Susan regarded the expression critically, nodded, and slipped her arm through mine. We walked in under the cover our smiles provided. One of the security guards stopped us inside the door, and Susan presented the tickets to him. He waved us through. "First thing to do is find some stairs," I said from behind my smile. "The loading docks will be near the kitchens, and they're below us. That's where they'll be bringing in the art stuff." Susan held her course toward the stairs. "Not yet," she said. "If we snoop around the second we get in the door, someone is likely to notice. We should mingle until the auction is running. People will be distracted then. If we wait, the whole thing could go down while we hobnob." "Maybe," Susan said, "but odds are that Anna Valmont and the buyer are both thinking the same thing." "When does the auction start?"
11.
"Assuming the note means that the sale is at 11:45, that doesn't give us much time to look around. This place is huge." We got onto an escalator, and Susan arched an eyebrow at me. "Do you have any better ideas?" "Not yet," I said. I caught a glimpse of myself in a polished brass column. I didn't look half bad. There's a reason the tux has weathered a century, virtually unchanged. You don't fix what isn't broken. Tuxedos make anyone look good, and I was a living testament to it. "Think they'll have anything to eat? I'm starving." Just keep the shirt clean, Susan muttered. No problem. I can wipe my fingers on the cummerbund. I can't take you anywhere, Susan said. She leaned a little against me, and it felt nice. I felt nice, generally speaking. I cleaned up pretty well, it would seem, and I had a lovely woman. No, I had Susan on my arm, looking lovely. It was a small silver lining, compared to the troubled clouds I'd been floundering through, but it was something, and it lasted all the way up the escalator. I take the good moments wherever I can get them. We followed the flow of formally dressed men and women up another escalator or three to a cavernous ballroom. Chandeliers hung from the ceiling, and tables laden with expensive-looking snacks and ice sculptures all but overflowed onto the floor. A group of musicians played on the far side of the ballroom. They didn't seem to be stretching themselves with some relaxed and classy jazz. Couples who also weren't stretching themselves danced together on a floor the size of a basketball court. The room wasn't crammed with people, but there were a couple of hundred there already, and more coming in behind us. Polite but insincere chatter filled the space, accompanied by equally insincere smiles and laughter. There were a number of city officials whom I recognized in the immediate area, plus a couple of professional musicians and at least one motion picture actor. A waiter in a white jacket offered us a tray of champagne glasses, and I promptly appropriated a pair of them, passing the first to Susan. She lifted the glass to her mouth but didn't drink. The champagne smelled good. I took a sip, and it tasted good. I'm not a terribly impressive drinker, so I stopped after the first sip. Chugging down champagne on an empty stomach would probably prove inconvenient if it turned out I needed to do any quick thinking, or quick leaving, or quick anything. Susan said hello to an older couple and stopped for introductions. I kept my duck blind of a smile in place and mouthed appropriately polite phrases in the right spots. My cheeks had already started hurting. We repeated that for half an hour or so while the band played a bunch of low-key dance music. Susan knew a lot of people. She'd been a reporter in Chicago for 5 or 6 years before she'd had to leave town, but she had evidently managed to ingratiate herself to more people than I would have guessed. You go, Susan. Food, I said, after a stooped older man kissed Susan's cheek and walked away. Feed me, Seymour. It's always the brainstem with you, she murmured. But she guided us over to the refreshment table so that I could pick up a tiny sandwich. I didn't wolf the thing down in one bite, which was just as well, since it had a toothpick through it to hold it together, but the sandwich didn't last long. At least chew with your mouth closed, Susan said. I took a second sandwich.
I can't help it. I got all kinds of joie de vivre, baby.
And smile. Chew and smile? At the same time? Do I look like Jackie Chan? She had a retort, but it died after a syllable. I felt her hand tighten on my arm. I briefly debated wolfing the second sandwich just to get it out of the way, but I took the more sophisticated option. I put it in my jacket pocket for later and turned to follow Susan's gaze. I looked just in time to meet the gaze of Gentleman Johnny Marcone. He was a man of slightly above average height and unassuming build. He had handsome but unremarkable features. Central casting would have placed him as the genial next-door neighbor. He didn't have the usual boater's tan, it being February and all, but the crow's feet at the corners of his pale green eyes remained. He looked a lot like the fictional public image he projected, that of a normal, respectable businessman, an American tale of middle class made good. That said, Marcone scared me more than any single human being I'd ever met. I'd seen him produce a knife from his sleeve faster than a hyper-strong psychotic could swing a tire iron at him. He'd thrown another knife through a rope while spinning in circles as he hung upside down in the dark later the same night. Marcone may have been human, but he wasn't normal. He'd taken control of Chicago's organized crime during a free-for-all gang war, and he'd run it ever since despite the efforts of both everyday and supernatural threats. He'd done it by being deadlier than anything that came after him. Of all the people in the room, Marcone was the only one I could see who wasn't wearing a fake smile. It didn't look like he was particularly troubled by the fact either.
"Mr. Dresden," he said. "And Miss Rodriguez, I believe. I didn't realize you were an art collector."
"I am the foremost collector of velvet Elvi in the city of Chicago," I said at once.
"Elvi?" Marcone inquired. The plural could be Elvises, I guess, I said. But if I say that too often, I start muttering to myself, calling things my precious, so I usually go with the Latin plural. Marcone did smile that time. It was a cool expression. Tigers with full stomachs wear smiles like Marcone's when they're watching baby deer play. Ah, I hope you can find something.